This is number 24-2968, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation against the Secretary. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Samir Degasen for Novartis. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
I plan to spend the bulk of my time today on the excessive fines claim because that's the claim unique to our case. And we think the district court's decision was seriously flawed. And if adopted by this court, I think would have very far-reaching consequences. But I do want to just spend a few minutes talking about the other claims, two issues that actually were mentioned in the previous argument. One is I'd like to just talk quickly about how our takings argument is a little bit different from the one that this court heard in BMS Janssen and how we think it gives the court a more straightforward path to finding a constitutional violation. And I'd like to quickly talk about First Amendment remedy. So on the takings issue, we think that this case is resolved by a key principle the Supreme Court articulated in Horn, which is that the government cannot make parties submit to a physical taking as a condition of being able to sell their product in interstate commerce. And in trying to distinguish Horn, the government, you know, time and again relies on this false premise, which is that the government is the direct purchaser of the drugs. But just like in Horn, this case involves purely private transactions between a seller and a purchaser in a market that the government has chosen to regulate and subsidize. Manufacturers sell their drugs to wholesalers at commercial prices. The wholesalers then sell them to pharmacies who distribute them to individuals over 65. Those over 65s contract with private entities in the form of Part D plans who insure them for the cost of their drugs. And then, and only then, does the government come into play by subsidizing the Part D plans in order to lower the cost?
In Horn, there was a physical taking of the raisins. Where's the physical taking here?
The physical taking is the access provision in the statute. So that, and it is just as much a physical compulsion. That is section.
Access isn't physical possession.
It is, absolutely. If you combine the access provision, which says that we have to give access to the maximum fair price, which means
it's access to a price, not to a product.
Oh, I mean, it certainly means access to the product because if you have to access a price, then you have to obviously give access to the underlying product.
If otherwise, you choose to enter the agreement, you don't have to enter the agreement.
The only
reason you, quote, have to enter the agreement is the back end compulsion about the penalties, right? It causes downstream consequences if you don't enter the agreement, right?
Well, in exactly the same way that the grape manufacturers had to give up their raisins because there would be a penalty, a fine. There would be a fine.
So just to pick up on what Judge Hardiman said, I don't think it is the exact same way. In Horn, if you were selling raisins, the government got a cut. It didn't matter who you sold them to. They always walked out with a cut, and it was a physical cut. In this case, you can sell your drugs however you want. It's only by electing to participate in the Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement programs that the government now can say what it wants. So there's an extra step here. This isn't Horn. If you never want to be part of the programs, the government never gets a cut. You can sell your products all you want.
But that's what the government was saying in Horn. That's the exact argument they made. They said, if you don't want,
sell, it was don't sell in a program. And I think there's a difference. I agree with Horn. The answer can't be just don't sell your products and then we won't take a cut. But in this case, it's just don't sell your products in our program and we won't take a cut.
That's what they were saying in Horn. The program was the government's regulation of the raisin market. I mean, this is how Justice Sotomayor describes it in her dissent. Insofar as the Horns wish to sell some raisins in a market regulated by the government, that's the raisin market, and at a price supported by governmental intervention. Remember, the government was saying there, we're really helping you out. Without us, the price of raisins are going to crater. It's going to be a total disaster. So we're doing you a favor. The order, this is the rest of the quote, the order requires they give up the right to sell a portion of those raisins at that price, and instead accept disposal of them at a lower price.
I don't think they could opt out in Horn of the marketing order. I don't think that was an opt out.
But they could opt out of, they were great. Remember, they are grape farmers. They're people who farm grapes. And the government said, of course you can opt out of the government regulated component here, because what you can do is instead of selling your grapes to the federally regulated market as raisins, you can sell your grapes instead to wine manufacturers, and the only reason you don't do that is because we're giving you such a great deal on the raisin side. We're supporting this raisin market, and without us, the raisin market would crater, and we're giving you a good deal, and that's why you're selling your grapes as raisins. But if you don't like it, you can opt out and you can sell your grapes to the wine people. This is exactly the same area here where we want to sell to over 65s. The government says we regulate the market for sales to over 65s and we do a great job. We help you out so much. If you don't like it though, don't sell to over 65.
Was the government in Horn buying the raisins and distributing them to senior citizens?
I honestly don't think the analysis changes. If you think of Horn,
I'll take that as a no.
But they were taking the raisins.
Was the government taking the raisins and selling them?
Yes.
And selling them to senior citizens.
Well, not to senior citizens, but they were selling the raisins, the farmers retained a contingent interest, and they're being paid back money as a result of the government.
I don't know. It's a totally different context. Here, you have a government as a market participant. The government is not only a market participant; the government is dominating the market. Everybody's briefs say that approximately 50% of the spending in this area comes from the federal government, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So if the government is the big purchaser and the big spender here, one would expect the government to negotiate the same sort of extraordinarily narrow margins that other dominant market participants in the private sector extract. Anybody who does business with big companies like Amazon, Apple, Walmart, the margins are razor thin, right?
I agree with all that, Your Honor.
Okay, so here the government could extract razor thin margins on the massive quantities of pharmaceuticals that the government is buying. And all it has to do is the Congress of the United States needs to pass a law putting into legal effect those razor thin margins. Problem solved, correct?
I think that's why I started with the idea the government is not a purchaser in this market. The government is regulating third-party transactions. We're trying to sell to over
65. The government's spending the money. The government's not buying the drugs directly. There are intermediaries here, but the government's the purchaser.
The government is spending the money like the government be spending the money in a low-income housing program, would be spending the money in a food voucher program. All regulatory programs, the government spends money at the back end. But this is not, the government in this case tries to portray this as, this is like the DOD, we're just buying it as a purchaser. Horn would come out differently, I think, if the government was the only purchaser of raisins, but it wasn't. It was a regulator, and this is exactly the same kind of regulation. And that's why I started with that. Once you look at the analogy, I think it is very similar. I'll move on to the First Amendment because I don't have much time, but I will just add one thing just because you mentioned the 30-day requirement. We do think that is contrary to the statute, the idea that they could withdraw within 30 days. And I'll note one other thing about that, which is that if we were not able to withdraw within 30 days, then we would have to sign the agreement. And then if you look at section 1320F6A, that says any manufacturer of a selected drug that's entered into an agreement under section 1320F2 of this title. So once they've entered into an agreement that does not provide access to a price that's equal or less than the maximum fair price shall be subject to civil monetary penalties. So we couldn't get out because of 30 days, and then we would then be subject to the civil monetary penalties, even if we withdrew from Medicare and Medicaid.
The reason you can't get out within 30 days is because the statute says it's 11 to 23 months.
Exactly. And so, and we would
when
be-
Congress gives an agency the discretion and uses a term like good cause, and allows the secretary to determine what good cause is. How is it possible to say what the secretary has determined is unreasonable and contrary?
I think you can't read the statute in a way where good cause duplicates something else the statute provides for. The statute provides for the manufacturers to withdraw. I don't think you can read the statute fairly as saying, and the agency can say good cause is the manufacturer wants to withdraw on a different timetable to the timetable the statute already provides for the manufacturer to withdraw. So I think that
seems perfectly reasonable. And in other circumstances, you might say, well, normally, we're gonna require a timetable to be a certain thing. But if somebody shows good cause, we're gonna let them get away with less time. I mean, what's unreasonable about that?
But I think the good cause can't just be that they would like to withdraw, because the statute already provides for a framework for when they would like to withdraw and puts a timeline for that. And so then it can't be that is duplicated by the government being able to say the good cause is just the desire to withdraw. But
the desire to withdraw, it's the desire to not pay the excise tax. You could come up with a whole list of reasons. It's because the secretary likes your clients. So if that's good cause and the secretary says so, what is the limiting principle on good cause?
I think it can't be something that violates the structure of how the statute is designed. And you sort of have our argument that if the statute is designed such that there's another provision, another gateway here, then good cause can't be read to sort of swallow that gateway.
It seems like a good cause is an exception, is set up as an exception to the standard principle.
Right. So just to move on to the First Amendment remedy very quickly, because I know that also came up in the previous argument.
I'm sorry. Do you want to address the Eighth Amendment first or after the First Amendment?
After the First Amendment, I'll just say two very quick things on the First Amendment. One is, I think it's important to see the First Amendment violation here is not just the use of these specific words, but these words in the context of a sham negotiation, performed negotiation. So what the statute compels us, you know, it says the government has to make an offer. We have to make them a counteroffer. We have to agree that
it's only a sham negotiation if you have to reach an agreement. And that gets back to the exit issue, right? I mean, if it can't be a sham a negotiation because the government has too much bargaining power, right? I mean, then every single defense contract would be a sham negotiation. I mean, it's like saying that the one party has superior bargaining power, it's not a real negotiation. Well, in a commonsensical way, it's not, because the party with superior bargaining power gets to dictate the terms. But in a legal sense, it's not a sham.
I agree with all that, but the bargaining power can't be the exercise of coercive sovereign power. I mean, this is how we phrase it in our complaint. This is at JA-52. The negotiation claimed by the program is not really a negotiation. Unlike in a genuine negotiation, manufacturers are compelled to participate, compelled to provide any information, including proprietary and highly confidential information that their counterparty demands, compelled to base any counteroffer on a limited number of factors unilaterally designated by the counterparty, and ultimately compelled to accept whatever offer the counterparty settles on or face intentionally ruinous penalties at every step. So that's not a negotiation in any way, for reasons totally independent of the fact that the government is a powerful actor. That's just a lot of aspects of this that just are not negotiations.
But the ruinous penalties do a lot of work
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because, I mean, look, there are a lot of doctors and hospitals and other medical providers that say, I have to do business with Medicare and Medicaid, right? But there are other groups of doctors and medical professionals that say, you know what, the government made it so disadvantageous, I'm not going to take Medicaid patients. I'm not going to take Medicare patients. That's a reality, is it not?
That's all a reality. But what?
And you could do the same thing here. You could choose to not sell Entresto to the federal government. The problem is, if you choose not to do that, there are all kinds of other downstream consequences, like you're out of business, but the right? Problem, that's your argument, but as I
problem,
understand it.
The problem for the First Amendment is completely separate, which is that they, as part of this process, completely separate from that, they made us engage in a sham negotiation that is not a negotiation, because there were all these provisions that force us to basically accept what the other side in the negotiation is doing. And they
But that's
made
only
us
because
that.
Of the exit penalty. Without the exit penalty, you can walk the deal. You could make the same decision that those medical providers who have made the decision, I'm not dealing with the federal government, it's too onerous. You could make that decision.
Yeah, it's because of the penalty, it's because of all the compelled information that we have to provide. There's lots of elements of this that say you have to do certain things that you would never do in a normal negotiation.
Well, isn't it true though that people doing business with the Defense Department have all kinds of onerous reporting requirements about the munitions and other things that they're selling to the Defense Department? And the complaint can't be, oh, they're making it very difficult for me to sell missiles and airplanes to the federal government. That can't be the argument. If you don't like all the detailed reporting requirements and maybe even sharing some of your proprietary information, then you don't do business with the government.
Sure, Your Honor. But even if you just think it is the $93.1 billion penalty at the end of the day, that's not a negotiation because we have to accept it. So, and for the purpose of the First Amendment, the point I was trying to make was, if you think of all of that as being the First Amendment violation, as well as just the MFP, it's not just the words MFP, it's that the statute makes us do all of that in order to reach an MFP, something the statute calls the MFP. And I think that you phrased it really well, Judge Hahnemann, people can connect the dots. So they look at all of that and they say, oh, well, what all of that means together is that, and is that they reach an MFP, and that is the maximum fair price. That is the thing which means that the other prices are not fair, that the previous prices were not fair. So all of that is compelled speech, is a message that we have to convey.
You know, in terms of the breadth of the message, not to reference the prior oral argument, but the point was, it's all private. And so I thought I heard counsel for the government say, these agreements don't have to be made public. And so in terms of the breadth of the message, aren't you in total control of that?
But as Judge Hardiman said, the statute is public and the performance and the negotiation, everyone knows.
But I know, but breadth of the message. I know all that's public. Breadth of the message. Aren't you in control of that?
No, we're compelled.
Because you enter the agreement and you can determine who gets it. It does not give you control over breadth of message?
Because the message that's being conveyed to the public is these manufacturers engage in negotiation and they agreed to a maximum fair price. And we've been forced to perform the negotiation and then forced to sign an agreement. Everyone knows we sign an agreement for something called a maximum fair price. And everyone knows at the end of the day what that maximum fair price is. So all of that is compelled speech that creates a message. And the reason Congress wanted to do that is because price caps are very unpopular. They didn't want to do it this other way involving price caps. So what they did is they performed, it's called the drug price negotiation.
So if I understand your point, it would be even without the contract, even if the contract was under seal and no one could ever see it, just illegal to show the contract to anyone, you would still have a First Amendment challenge?
I think we would, Your Honor, because what the statute does is it compels the performance of negotiation and it compels us to still have signed something called an MFP. And everyone knows that we've signed an MFP and agreed to it. Everyone knows what that price is at the end of the day. So all of the things that are conveyed to the public are going to be exactly the same.
Kind of blur speech and action, don't you think? Got a little bit of a blurring of speech and action on that one.
Just like in Bonnet, just like in Papert, like the cases which involve saluting the flag at the same time as saying the Pledge of Allegiance. You kind of have a union of speech and conduct, but the key thing is that overall, you create an expressive message. And the point on remedy I was trying to make is that the statute without that is a different statute. Congress wanted to present to the world a statute involving negotiations. If you take all of that out, it's not clear that Congress would have passed the same statute. I would just like to—
So just hit me on remedy again. What remedy do you propose? Just void everything? Or void maximum fair price is used in the statute, not just the agreement?
I think you have to void everything because the issue is what is this if you void the component of the statute. So this is the manufacturer agreement component of the statute. And it says, and this is what we have to do as a matter of the statute, the secretary and the manufacturers have to negotiate to determine the maximum fair price, and they have to agree to the maximum fair price. So those are things the statute compels us to do. And so if you void that part of the statute doesn't work anymore because the agreement is the thing which triggers the penalties, is the thing which triggers
maximum. Is there a compelled speech case that's ever done that before? Janus didn't do that. They just voided agency fees. Woolley didn't do that. It just got rid of live free or die. No one's ripped this entire statute out of the code book before based on a compelled speech point, have they?
I think that there isn't a statute where compelled speech is at the heart of the program in exactly this way. The whole point of this.
Janus, the agency fees. You read the briefs on that, I'm sure, and you saw how the union said, the sky is falling. It won't be the same. Labor relations in America will never be the same again without agency fees. It's kind of close to where you're at, right?
Well, but I think the question is still one of legislative intent, which is, would Congress have wanted a statute that basically looks like a price cap and doesn't look like a negotiation anymore? And I think when it passed the drug price negotiation program, it wanted to convey to the public that this was the result of a negotiation. Some of these, I'm very happy to answer more questions on this. I also, as a result of some of this colloquy, have not been able to get to my Eighth Amendment argument. It would be wonderful if I could have just 2 minutes to talk about the Eighth Amendment argument before the rebuttal time. And I'm just gonna address, I think, the AIA, because I know that's the grounds for the decision below. So the AIA was passed in 1867 in direct response to suits to enjoin the collection of the nation's first income taxes. As every single AIA precedent stresses, the purpose of the AIA is, quote, to protect the federal government's ability to collect a consistent stream of revenue. In over 150 years, no government has ever tried to use the AIA in the way the government is here, which is to deliberately set a penalty so high that it is not payable, to then label it a tax, and then to say, well, the only way you could ever challenge this is by going through a refund action that is by definition impossible because this is an unpayable penalty. And if you think if you endorse that argument, there is no limit to how the AIA can be abused to shield unconstitutional penalties. Luckily, I think there are two pathways the court could choose around that. One is the text of the AIA itself, and the other is the Williams packing exception. On the text of the AIA itself, the AIA does not say that everything labeled a tax is barred. What it says is that no suit should be maintained for the purpose of restraining the assessment or collection of taxes. And in CIC services, there were three factors that the court, Supreme Court looked to. One is, most importantly, the relief requested, the thing sought to be enjoined. If you look at our complaint, JA 86, paragraph 123, this is what we seek: enjoin defendants from forcing Novartis to sign an initial manufacturer agreement or to agree to prices set by the program. We do not seek an injunction against the tax. We have never sought an injunction against the tax. We have sought an injunction.
But paragraph 120, you asked the district court to declare that the program's excise tax violates the excessive fines clause.
Correct. And I think the court could do that without an injunction, but that would be subject to the Declaratory Judgment Act separate provision involving declaratory judgment relating to a tax. Even if you think that that relief is barred, that doesn't mean that the AIA bars the relief that we actually seek in our complaint, which is not an injunction against the tax. So that's the thing, you know, as the Supreme Court said, the AIA kicks in when the target of a requested injunction is a tax obligation. So we
think excessive fine is just the outlandishly high penalty you'd have to pay.
Right? A 93.
It's a prohibitive penalty. It's so prohibitive, the government scored it as zero revenue.
It's not, I mean, even on any common sense basis, no one thinks that they are collecting $93 billion for the act of not agreeing. This is the act of just not agreeing, of saying, we don't want to negotiate. We don't want to agree. Completely innocent conduct, a $93 billion penalty. If you just step back, it's so, unbelievably exceptional in the history of modern legislature to do something like that. And that's the second factor I was going to point to, which is if someone is several steps removed from the tax, and stands nowhere near the cusp of tax liability. Those are the quotes from CIC. We will never pay this tax, and this tax would exist with or without, whether or not there's going to be a lawsuit or not, that this tax was never, ever going to be collected. So how could our suit be for the purpose of restraining or collecting taxes if no tax was ever intended to be collected?
All right. We understand your argument on that. We'll hear you on rebuttal.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you. Let's hear from Ms. Potty.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Catherine Potty for the United States. I'd like to start by picking up on the discussion about the Eighth Amendment claim and the Anti-Injunction Act. This one is not a close call. Congress was very clear that this is a tax, said over and over again that this is a tax, and the Supreme Court has made clear that whether the Anti-Injunction Act applies or not is a matter of statutory interpretation. So the words Congress uses, that's the whole ballgame here. With respect to whether this is a suit that is directed toward the tax itself, all you have to do is go to the page in the complaint that my friend directed you to, which says that in the prayer for relief, the ask with respect to the Eighth Amendment claim is to declare that the excise tax violates the excessive fines clause. If you go two pages up with respect on page 84, that's where the part of the complaint addressing the excessive fines clause claim finishes, and at the very end, you see that the program's excise tax is therefore unconstitutional under the excessive fines clause of the Eighth Amendment. So everything about the complaint is seeking relief, seeking a declaration that the tax is unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court has said over and over again that if on the face of the complaint, the objective aim of the lawsuit is to seek relief against the tax itself, then the Anti-Injunction Act applies. My friend talks about how what they really want or their true motivations are something different, but the court said explicitly in CIC services that courts are not to inquire into the subjective motive, so their own feeling that they don't ever intend to pay the tax no matter what happens, because down that path lies too much potential for circumventing the act. That's directly from CIC services. So also want to explain that in CIC services, the court distinguished between a claim that has the downstream effect of resulting in the lack of collection of a tax versus one that is targeted toward the tax itself. We have an example of that in this very lawsuit. We're not arguing that the Eighth Amendment or that the First Amendment claim or the Fifth Amendment claim are barred by the Anti-Injunction Act, even though if those claims were successful, it would have the downstream effect of resulting in no tax collection under the excise tax provision. That's very
well. I'm not sure why that's true on the First Amendment. If the remedy for the first, if we were to find a First Amendment violation and the remedy were to simply strike maximum fair price, it's a sort of immaterial to the functioning of the program, isn't it? In terms of the program's all about money, right? The program's about saving the taxpayer money. It's about making the Medicare, Medicaid programs, giving them some semblance of solvency. Striking maximum fair price doesn't do anything to undermine those goals, does it?
That's true with respect to the remedy the court has proposed, and I would like to address that when we get to the First Amendment section. My point was just to use the other claim, for example, the Fifth Amendment claim then, as an illustration of the difference between a claim that will have the downstream effect of restraining the collection of a tax as a result, if the court found the program unconstitutional, versus a claim that is directed toward the tax itself, like this one, which seeks a declaration that the tax is unconstitutional. I'm happy.
The NFIB says that we have to accord, almost accept as truth, the Congress's moniker that it's a tax.
Correct? That's right, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that the AIA is a statute. So this whole thing is a matter of statutory interpretation. So the words Congress uses, that's the whole ballgame. If they call it a tax and they could choose whether to apply the statute to other things, but they chose to apply it to the things that they call taxes. And this statute was enacted against that backdrop of understanding elaborated through Supreme Court decisions. I'm happy to address the Williams-Packing exception. I think the key thing here is that it must be clear that under no circumstances could the government prevail. There's nothing close to that sort of showing here. And in Bob Jones, the court emphasized that Williams-Packing closed the door on some prior analysis that focused only on the extent of the harm and rather emphasized and said that the government has to have no chance of prevailing for the exception to kick in. If there are no further questions on the tax questions, I'm happy to move to, I'd like to respond to some of the First Amendment discussion that we were having earlier.
What about, is there anything you want to say about standing on tax collection and kind of who got sued and who didn't get sued, more the latter?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think it is clear that plaintiffs did not include the IRS and Treasury as defendants in the complaint. I don't want to speculate too broadly as to why, but the relevance of the Anti-Injunction Act could be part of that strategic decision. But here, the court in Lujan and in Brackeen has made clear that the specific agency that is charged with enforcing the government action that is alleged to be unconstitutional has to be named as a defendant in the case, and that whether it's an injunction or declaratory relief, it must it only binds the particular agencies that are named in the as defendants, and the IRS and Treasury were not named here.
Can't they be joined?
I think at this stage, Your Honor, would be inappropriate to join the IRS and Treasury as defendants, and that would not overcome the true barrier here, which is the Anti-Injunction Act bar. And so it would not make a particular difference. And again, that was a potentially conscious choice on their part, given the existence of the Anti-Injunction
Act. And so in terms of order of operations, Anti-Injunction Act is jurisdictional, standing is jurisdictional. So I guess kind of it sounds strange to say, but we don't need to address Article III if we reach the Anti-Injunction Act the way that you say is very clear. Flip side is if we disagree with you there, we're off to standing.
That's right. Because they're both jurisdictional, the court could address them in either order. And the Anti-Injunction Act here is very clear, and it's not a close call, as we discussed earlier. With respect to First Amendment, if there are no further questions on the Eighth Amendment claim, I did want to address the court's proposal that there's an easy fix to the problem here. I do understand that intuition, but I want to be clear that it would be a big decision to hold that a private party's signature on a form government contract is speech implicating the First Amendment. Court would be the first to hold such a thing, and that would be an extraordinary expansion of First Amendment law.
Are there any other statutes that say that the contracting party is agreeing to the maximum fair price.
None that use that phrase.
Well, then, if this is the first time a statute's ever said that, we shouldn't be surprised that this might be the first court to say that's problematic.
So I first, the question is whether the signature on a form contract that, again, is never even made public, but for the conduct of my friends in including that public agreement in this litigation, to determine first whether that agreement is speech when they are not being asked to announce that to the world at all, would itself, I mean, I think that initial question comes before the downstream question of what the import of maximum fair price means. I do want to acknowledge that there could be theoretically terms in a contract that would support an inference that what was really going on here was that the government was trying to get the party to endorse a particular message. For example, if a contract included the Pledge of Allegiance, I think
that's obvious what's going on here. And it's not a Pledge of Allegiance. This is a commercial case. But isn't it patently obvious that commercially what's going on here is the federal government is hoping through this program to do a few things. One is to reduce healthcare costs in the Medicare and Medicaid programs, but also in light of the fact that these companies that are getting massive quantities of federal dollars through Medicare and Medicaid, they're also operating in the private sector, right? And if these companies have to represent that the prices that are substantially lower than the prices they were previously charging are the maximum fair prices, that should have a very depressive price effect on the private market as well. Would it not?
That's exactly the thing, is they're not being asked to represent that. They are being asked to sign a form government contract that uses statutory terms. Fair price is all over government contract. It's in the federal acquisition regulations. Maximum is a word that is added here because it is literally true. It is actually the maximum. So fair price is everywhere. The addition of the word maximum really does not transform this into something that is akin to the Pledge of Allegiance.
So, I mean, but I think so I'm back at Woolley. Okay, and I'm back at Woolley v. Maynard. And so, you know, there one of the concerns was that the message live free or die was ideological. And so you're basically asking people to carry out the state's message, right? Now, it's not just that it's our state motto, but we want you to drive around with our state motto and show everyone our state motto. And here the government's message is that it's maximum fair price. And you now say, we want you in your contract to agree to our message, maximum fair price. And so it feels that that's a little bit similar in the sense that the government wants this message because this is a big, important program. And so they don't want to, you know, the more that it feels like a cram down, you know, the harder that is. And so now maybe the pharmaceutical companies don't feel that it's the maximum fair price, but you're making them say it.
So with respect to the license plate example, I mean, there's nothing more public than driving around with two license plates on the front and back of your car with this motto on here. Again, this agreement would not be public, but for this litigation. And I do think that your colloquy with my friend really illustrated the issue here. I mean, they objected to your hypothetical that there could be an entirely private contract and that they would object to this sort of gives the game away. This is not about what the contract says. Same with their insistence that if that phrase cannot be severed from the, or that phrase should not be severed from the contract, but rather the whole statute should fall as unconstitutional. I mean, that's what they're going after.
What if we don't give them that? What if we agree with them there's a First Amendment violation and the remedy is to strike the phrase from the contracts? Does that do any harm to the program? Does the program collapse? Does the program not go forward?
I do think that it would have very far-reaching consequences to hold that a signature on such a contract constitutes speech implicating the First Amendment. But even if we move
I don't think Judge Hardiman's question went to the signature. I think he went to the keep everything, but maybe strike the reference to maximum fair price. Or again, in Woolley, it wasn't no license plate. It was no live free or die. I don't know if I got that. Yeah.
No, I do understand that the remedy the intuition that the remedy could be confined here. What I want to emphasize is that the reach of the court's opinion would not be confined here, because before you get to remedy, you have to find that there's a violation. So that means one, you have to find that this signature is not conduct, but it's speech. This is something that's never been done before. Second, you have to get to—
No, I'm not talking about the signature.
I understand.
Again, before you explain the parade of horribles that will ensue if we find a First Amendment violation here, tell me, if we do the thing that you don't want us to do, and we say there's a First Amendment violation, and then we do the thing that your friend on the other side doesn't want us to do and refuse to strike the whole scheme, and we simply say that the agreement does not have to say maximum fair price. I'm just curious about the practical ramifications for this program if we're doing that. I'm asking a practical question.
I understand, Your Honor. And I think that your intuition that the program itself would not fall to pieces is correct. I do think that the equitable remedies inherent in contract reformation would be better addressed by the district court in the first instance. But I think if that answers your question about the specific remedy, I do want to emphasize that before you get to the intuitive appeal of a small remedy, you have to find that there's a First Amendment violation. Even after you move past the conduct and speech distinction here, I want to point out that there are two theories that they offer for First Amendment violations. One is the compelled speech theory, and this court has made clear that there's no compelled speech in the absence of actual compulsion. So what we're looking—
Right, and that keeps getting us back to the exit. Because if there were no exit penalty in this statute, then it's hard for them to argue that they're being compelled to say something in a form contract that says anything when it's their choice to do business with the government, and they can just turn their backs and walk away and say, we're not doing business with the government.
That's right, Your Honor. And I understand your point that the statute provides for this 11 to 23 month termination period when a manufacturer says we want to withdraw.
That's what the statute says.
Yes, but what the statute also says is that CMS may terminate a contract for good cause. And good cause is a capacious concept that accounts for circumstances that are not spelled out in the
statute. Capacious, but it's a strong argument to suggest that it's capacious enough to render nugatory every other word in the statute.
It would not do so, Your Honor. CMS would not permit a 30-day withdrawal from Medicare or Medicaid unless, for other reasons. There are, you know, all sorts of reasons that a manufacturer may choose to withdraw. And if they do so, they must follow the ordinary provisions in the statute that you laid out. CMS has said that your constitutional objections to this program, we will determine that that is good cause for you to withdraw from the statute. That is a reasonable interpretation of the statutory phrase good cause. It does not render a nugatory, or does not render surplus.
All right, so that's interesting. Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying that the good cause requirement can modify the 11 to 23 month provision in the statute because CMS has made a good faith determination that the 11 to 23 month exit horizon presents constitutional problems in the statute.
No, Your Honor, CMS does not consider that to present a constitutional problem. I was explaining that CMS considers plaintiffs' constitutional objections to be sufficient for CMS to invoke this good cause option. So CMS does not believe—
All right, but that is really interesting and gives me pause, because if any time a litigant raises a constitutional challenge to a statute, that empowered an administrative agency to act in derogation of the statute for prudential reasons, that seems to really cause statutes to evaporate.
No, not at all, Your Honor. The ability for CMS to terminate an agreement for example, manufacturer misconduct is one sort of category of reasons, but then good cause addresses all any other circumstance. And here, CMS has explained in its guidance that it would permit withdrawal within 30 days if the manufacturer does so for this reason. That does not negate the ability of the manufacturer to raise any other reason and withdraw from the program if they so choose, and then they follow those other provisions that you.
So this reason and this reason alone is a 30-day exit, and every other reason is the 11 to 23-month exit?
Yes, there's no inconsistency between those two provisions.
The 11 to 23 months is by statute, the CMS doesn't have to be involved. They don't get to say yay or nay. That is an entitlement to get out in 11 to 23 months.
That's right.
CMS only gets involved if someone is seeking a shorter exit period.
That's right, with respect to this particular program.
And what are the parameters under which a party would be entitled to the 30-day earlier exit?
So the party.
What are the rules of the road to be entitled to that 30-day withdrawal?
The party needs to give notice to CMS of its intention to do so because of its objection to the negotiation program provisions. The statute itself has this 30-day window, which is why it's no shorter than 30 days. And that notice automatically, from CMS's perspective, would start that 30-day window. And then at the conclusion, they would be able to get out.
So when you say the good cause is the plaintiff's constitutional objection, which plaintiffs are you talking about and which constitutional objection?
So in the revised guidance, CMS has, I was speaking more colloquially, but in the revised guidance, CMS did explain that if they want to do so because of their objections to the negotiation.
Can you cite that provision for us?
It is on page, 56 of our brief, and JA 394, and JA 384, so describe.
Do you know what section of the guidance? I have the guidance document.
Revised guidance, pages 131. And 121.
So, we started your portion of this argument talking about this plaintiff's Eighth Amendment claim, which you think is a very clear loser. So if a plaintiff came to you with only an Eighth Amendment claim that aligns with the one that was pleaded in this complaint, would that be a good cause?
Yes, Your Honor, I did not intend to impose additional restrictions. In the guidance, CMS is clear that if the plaintiffs object to the negotiation program and that's why they want to get out of the program, that itself, I apologize for saying that it had to be for a specific constitutional reason. That's just the underlying theme motivating many of these.
So all they have to do is ask.
All you have to do is ask.
I mean, that seems like the exception swallows the rule, right?
No, Your Honor, because if you want to do so for other reasons, then you have to follow the normal process.
But you just say this reason.
Yeah, CMS.
I mean, you say, you may have other reasons, but you'd be a fool not to say, oh, and we think it's unconstitutional.
You would also be lying, Your Honor, if you were just to invoke this reason, if this were not your real reason. And CMS recognizes that this is a change in the Medicare program. And as you, Judge Hardiman, also recognize the ability to get out based on your understanding of different terms that the government is going to be using moving forward is important. And that the importance of that choice was recognized by the agency. If I could very briefly address the second type of First Amendment theory they raise, in addition to compelled speech, is the unconstitutional conditions theory. Those are truly the only two First Amendment theories that would ever be in play if that signature and the whole agreement were understood to be speech. First, compelled speech, second, unconstitutional conditions. And if you're in that second world, you are in the world and the legal framework that the Supreme Court set out in Rust. And in Rust, the court said that the speech within the confines of the government program are not, the court has broad latitude to set restrictions on that kind of speech and significantly less outside of the scope of the government program. So in Rust, for example, the recipients of family planning clinic recipients of government funding could not counsel their patients on the availability of abortion. That implicates matters, serious First Amendment concerns and matters of public concern far greater than maximum fair price. And the Supreme Court found no First Amendment problem there, even though the physicians in those clinics, if their patients asked about options for an abortion, were told to say, this project does not consider abortion an appropriate method of family planning. That is clearly speech, unlike the situation here, and it clearly implicates important matters of public concern, also of far greater significance than the ones here. And the Supreme Court said that was not a problem because those clinics could have affiliated clinics set up and could offer those options there. So those are the two theories. Compelled speech, which this court has made clear, does not apply in the absence of actual compulsion and unconstitutional conditions, in which case you're in the rest framework. And none of those, neither of those would be successful, even if this court were to take the extraordinary step of determining this to be speech and not conduct. If there are no further questions, we ask this court to affirm.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Patty. We'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start with the Williams packing exception since we didn't get the chance to get to it. And I do think this, you know, this is the I think the quintessential situation where this exception would apply. This is a $93 billion penalty for a completely innocent act. So the question is, are we certain to prevail on the merits? And, you know, is it a fine? The Supreme Court described it in Austin, a civil sanction that cannot fairly be said solely to serve a remedial purpose, but can be explained as either serving a retributive or deterrent purpose is a fine. No one doubts that this is serves a deterrent purpose, so it's a fine. Is it proportionate? There's no serious argument that it is disproportionate. The only thing, as far as I can see, the only argument they've given on the merits here is this argument that the Supreme Court itself squarely rejected in Austin, which is that there has to be some connection to a criminal proceeding. And this is what the Supreme Court said in Austin.
Yeah, it can be civil. Austin makes that clear.
Exactly. So what's the argument?
But you've got to show that you're certain to succeed on the merits also under Williams Packing, don't you?
Yeah, they have no arguments. So of course we're certain to succeed on the merits. I mean, their arguments are, you know, there's no question that it's a fine. There's no question it's disproportionate. So their only remaining argument is that, you know, the exact one that was rejected in Austin. I mean, I genuinely, if you look through that brief, I cannot imagine a more thin set of merits arguments on the question of whether this is...
I mean, the problem is it's just a novel question. And so how can we have certainty on such a novel question, right? You need certainty for prong one. And we don't have any certainty, at least in the case law.
Oh, I think things can be novel when they are egregiously...
Certainly and novel, yeah.
Exactly. When someone goes way beyond the bounds of their authority, that's novel. No one's ever tried it before because it's outrageous.
We don't even know if this is a fine. This is a tax.
Well, no, it's that's not an issue for purposes of the constitutional claim. That's what NFIB says. The Congress gets to say for the purposes of the
right.
AAA.
Correct. NFIB says that we don't have to accept Congress's representation
exactly.
As a tax, but it's still a debatable proposition as to whether it's...
I don't think it's a debatable proposition when the Congressional Budget Office scores it as zero revenue raised and when any common sense look at it recognizes that $93 billion for simply saying, I don't want to negotiate with you, completely under any reasonable interpretation, innocent conduct, is not a tax. It can never raise revenue because no one is going to say, well, I don't want to negotiate. I'm going to pay $93.1 billion. We introduced evidence in the district court, J88 to 98, saying we couldn't pay it. It would be, you know, enterprise destroying to pay that kind of fine. It's multiples of our national, you know, of our earnings. So there is absolutely no way anyone could pay it. Congress knew that. Congress said it at such an absurdly high level because they knew no one could pay it. That was the goal.
But let me get back to this kind of Austin and criminal activity. I mean, haven't other courts tied the excessive fines clause to criminal activity? I mean, First Circuit case, United States v. Toth.
Right. Toth is the only example that's even close. And, you know, Toth is way out on a limb as Justice Gorsuch's.
It at one level you need certainty. And if you were in the First Circuit, you wouldn't have had that certainty. So now that you're in the Third Circuit, you do have the certainty.
Yeah, I mean,
it certainly feels more universal to me than.
I guess I don't think so. And I think, you know, you can
look at a novel question.
You can look at it's novel because it's so egregious. No one has ever tried to do it before. So I think novelty doesn't help. The fact that you have Toth, I mean, this court
can
look at the...
We got novelty in the First Circuit. So we got novelty in the First Circuit, and then I'm supposed to have certainty. I may like your argument, but certainty is not likelihood of success on the merits. It's upstairs.
I mean, I think if you think that there is no serious argument on the other side, then we're certain to prevail on the merits in this court. So that, you know, and if you have to sort of predict what will the Supreme Court think about Toth, well, every other circuit that has considered this question, including the four circuits on the FCPA, on the FCA, including the Ninth Circuit, including the Eighth Circuit, you know, every single circuit that has looked at this question has said, this, you know, look, read Austin, read the words of Austin. Austin unequivocally rejects this. And that is their only argument on the merits. So I do think we win on the certainty of success factor.
Williams Packing says it has to be apparent that under the most liberal view of the law and the facts, Novartis would win.
Correct, Your Honor. I mean,
and so what do we call what the First Circuit did?
Wrong, egregiously wrong. And you see it all the time, Your Honor, where a case goes to the Supreme Court.
It's egregiously wrong. Okay.
You see all the time. I mean, I practice at the Supreme Court. You know, you see it all the time where a case goes up there and it's like there's a circuit split. One case is just unreasonable.
It's just weird, though, because the standard the Supreme Court gives us is kind of like take everybody else's temperature on this, too. And so if we're taking everybody else's temperature, the First Circuit comes in hot.
I think that the standard the Supreme Court gives you is to look at whether there are serious arguments the other side. And whether you have an outlier court that makes a mistake on that, I don't think is dispositive of your ability to look at the merits and decide that there are no serious arguments on the other side.
It just seems close to the qualified immunity standard. You almost need a case on point. And you don't remotely have a case on point because even Austin didn't hold that the excessive fines clause applies in civil case. It gestured toward that. It dicta. And it talks about punishment. It has to be punishment. And it's unclear whether this is punishment. I think this is a cudgel to bring the companies to heel. It seems more like that than punishment to me.
Well,
and the reason I don't think it's punishment is because, as you point out, it was scored as zero. They don't expect anyone to ever pay it. So it's a deterrent. It's the ultimate deterrent, right?
And deterrent is one of the things. That's what Austin says. Deterrent means it's a fine. A fine can be deterrent. And so if it's that, then it meets the criteria for a fine. But I feel like one way or another, you know, you have the AIA, and the AIA says, look at the purpose of the suit, and you have Williams Packing. And what they're in some ways both looking at is, if Congress just labels something, which is clearly not a tax, and the only reason you would ever, there's in no sense, as you said, was this aimed to raise revenue. It's called a tax because it's trying to invoke the AIA, because it's trying to shield it from judicial review. And that kind of abusive use of the AIA, there has to be some limit one way or another. And one way of looking at it is, you look at the object of the lawsuit. Here, we don't seek an injunction against the tax. We only seek an injunction against the coercion. And this is not a tax that's ever going to be paid, regardless of the lawsuit. So it cannot be, by definition, a lawsuit with the purpose of restraining tax collection. Case after case has said the purpose of the statute is to protect the government's consistent source of revenue. It is not meant to apply to a situation where the government is not trying to earn revenue at all. And so that's one way, one path through it, or another path through it.
Can you just square that with NFIB? Can you just square that with NFIB?
And NFIB says that where the Congress calls it a tax, that's dispositive as to whether it is labeled a tax. But the AIA does not say anything labeled a tax is barred from judicial review. What the AIA says is you look to the object of the lawsuit, the purpose of the lawsuit. And if the purpose of the lawsuit is to restrain the collection of a tax, then, you know, absolutely, that it's barred. But so, if you so, have something
so
if we which
look,
is...
So I asked your friend on the other side about this. You know, you didn't sue Treasury, you didn't sue IRS. And so if you would have sued Treasury and IRS, then the purpose of your lawsuit might steer you into that trouble. But if you don't sue them, haven't you purchased for yourself an Article III standing problem?
No, because we can still get the relief that we seek in our complaint at paragraph 123, which is...
Because we can join them under Rule 21? Is that your argument?
No, because I mean, that's one of our arguments, if you think that's a problem. But in response to Judge Phipps' question of have we purchased a redressability problem, no, because the thing which we seek is in 123 of the complaint, which is an injunction against the defendant, CMS, from forcing Novartis to sign an initial manufacture agreement or to agree to prices set by the program. So the thing we're saying is, we don't want to be, you know, you cannot make us agree. You cannot make us sign this agreement. That's the thing that we are asking for. And so that injury is redressable, regardless of whether IRS are joined. The point that the government is making, I think, is the same one they tried to make in CIC services, which is, well, the downstream consequence of giving you your relief is that we won't be able to levy a tax. That's exactly what they said in CIC. They said, you're asking for, and there it was, an injunction against the enforcement of the reporting requirement. And they said, well, that's enforced by a tax. So what you're really asking for is an injunction against the tax. And the Supreme Court said, you look to the relief requested in the complaint. If the complaint is not targeted at the tax, then it's not a suit for the purpose of restraining assessment of a tax. And that was a tax that could at least theoretically be collected. Here we have a tax that in no possible world will ever be collected. It is unrealistic. Any application of common sense would recognize that there is no way that a single dollar is going to be collected as a result of this tax. And yet they use a statute which You know, dozens of cases say the sole and singular purpose for over 150 years has been to protect the government's ability to collect a consistent stream of revenue. So it's a really abusive use of that statute, Your Honor, and there has to be one way or another, either the statutory text or Williams Packing, some way to prevent this kind of use of it. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you to all counsel for the excellent arguments. The court will take that case as well under advisement.